Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to appear in court following clashes between his supporters and security forces this week over an arrest warrant against him. South Korea moves to normalize a military pact with Japan 2 days after a summit aimed at rebuilding security ties. Also ahead, the British Interior Minister is in Rwanda to discuss a migration deal that has drawn widespread criticism over the rights of asylum seekers. Welcome. Our top story this hour, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to appear before the High Court in the capital Islamabad later in the day. That's according to his lawyer in Lahore. Imran Khan is accused of unlawfully selling state gifts given to him by foreign dignitaries when he was Prime Minister in 2018-2022. He denies any wrongdoing and had repeatedly refused to attend hearings on the case, citing safety concerns. Khan decided to show up in the High Court on Saturday after it cancelled an arrest warrant against him. The warrant triggered clashes between security forces and Khan supporters in his hometown Lahore earlier this week. The legal proceedings against Khan began after he was ousted from office in a parliamentary vote early last year. Since then, he has been holding protests across the country, calling for early elections. The government has so far refused his demand. North Korea says hundreds of thousands of its citizens have volunteered to join or re-enlist in the nation's military to fight against the United States. According to North Korea's state newspaper, 800,000 students and workers across the country expressed their will to counter the U.S. The report said the number of people willing to enlist is just for Friday. This comes after the country launched its largest ever intercontinental ballistic missile on Thursday. Pyongyang said the Hwasong-17 missile was launched to demonstrate what it called a tough response posture amid the ongoing military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. North Korea considers the exercises as acts of hostility and rehearsal for an invasion of its territory. And South Korea says it will fully implement a key military intelligence sharing pact with Japan. That comes 2 days after the two countries held a summit in Tokyo on Thursday to rebuild security and economy. Economic, that is, ties. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol told Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida that he wanted a complete normalization of their 2016 military agreement. The pact enables the two U.S. allies to share military secrets. Seoul had threatened to scrap the deal in 2019 as the relations with Tokyo soured, partly over a trade dispute. The two are concerned about what they see as security challenges posed by North Korea and China. Pyongyang and Beijing have repeatedly denied posing any such challenge. Now, an attorney for former U.S. President Donald Trump has been ordered to testify before a grand jury probing Trump's handling of classified documents related to his time in office. The ruling issued by a federal judge requires Evan Corcoran to provide additional testimony. That's because his communications with Trump may have been related to criminal conduct. Back in January, Corcoran declined to respond to investigators' questions, citing attorney-client privilege. Now, the latest ruling has removed the privilege, considering a crime fraud exception. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating Trump for keeping classified defense records at his Florida home. He has denied that, accusing the department of a witch hunt against him. Following the latest ruling, Trump's spokesperson said they will fight the Justice Department. Israeli violence has claimed the life of another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces opened fire on a Palestinian man near the city of Ramallah. The man was identified as 23-year-old Yazan Omar Jamal Khassab. He succumbed to his injuries in hospital. The Israeli military claims Khassab tried to stab the regime's troops. Israeli forces and settlers have ramped up their violence against Palestinians in recent months. The latest death brings to nearly 90 the number of Palestinians killed across the West Bank this year. 17 of those were children. Palestinians across the West Bank and Al-Quds have staged a 24-hour general strike to slam the recent killings in Jenin.
This is about helping our country by voting against this unfair and ineffective pension reform. It is about preserving our trampled parliamentary democracy and social democracy. It is about respecting and listening to our fellow compatriots, 80% of whom want this motion passed. Finally, the vote on this motion will help us emerge from a deep political crisis.
In other news, that was related to France, where a no-confidence motion against the French President Emmanuel Macron's overhaul of the retirement age has so far garnered 91 signatories from five opposition groups, which is nearly 200 votes short. The MPs who have put down their names have called on their colleagues to be responsible and back the statement. France has been plagued by paralyzing protests and sprawling strikes since the president announced his pension reform plans in January. Macron says he can only keep the system from collapsing by imposing the changes, but opponents say the overhaul is extremely unfair. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. British Interior Minister Suella Braverman is in Rwanda to discuss a controversial deal that sends migrants seeking asylum in the UK to the African nation. Braverman has said her trip aims to discuss plans to operationalise the deal shortly. London clinched the agreement with Kigali in April last year to send tens of thousands of migrants on a one-way trip to Rwanda. The plan hit a roadblock as the first deportation flight was cancelled by an injunction from the European Court of Human Rights. And in December, London's High Court ruled the scheme was lawful. The plan has drawn widespread criticism both in the UK and outside, including from the UN Refugee Agency. London says it wants to contain illegal migrants. Critics say the plan is inhumane. Joining us for more on that is John Stepling, an author and commentator from Inderøy, Norway. And we also have Mustafa Fatouri, a Libyan academic and journalist from Tripoli. Gentlemen, welcome. John, if I could start with you, is this UK immigration policy racist, in your opinion, sending or deporting the most vulnerable people to a country that they may never have even heard of before?
Well, of course it's racist. Look, it's also not an accident that the country that was picked out is Rwanda. The leader in human rights violations for all of Africa, run by a sadistic, torturing dictator, genocidal dictator in Paul Kagame. And of course that's where the British would strike a deal. And of course Kagame would accept that deal. He'd sell his mother for a pack of cigarettes, probably. Israel had a very similar plan in 2018 to deport black asylum seekers and immigrants, also to Rwanda, and I believe Uganda. They eventually scrapped the deal because of all sorts of complications and political problems surrounding it. But the hypocrisy of this is amazing, really, when you think about it, because the last two governments in the UK have constantly been The rhetoric of this new green agenda, stop flying, stop driving, but it's okay, we're going to send a bunch of immigrants 3,500 miles away on multiple flights. That's, you know, that's apparently green when they make money on it. But beyond that, of course, this is just pure an extension of colonial policy that has existed for 300 years. Britain was one of the leaders in this colonial policy. Now they work in tandem with the United States. The U.S., who has bases in all but one country, military bases in all but one country in Africa. It is the recolonization of Africa. They deal with the worst governments in Africa, led by Rwanda. It is just jaw-dropping because they're trying to sell this idea as humane is just nonsensical. It makes no sense. This is you know, in the shadow of Europe's embrace of Ukrainian refugees and all the demands that people sacrifice to accept Ukrainian refugees in this war, proxy war against Russia. Meanwhile, the people seeking asylum from all over Africa are doing so because they are escaping conflict zones created by the West, by the US and UK, by Western economic interests, mining interests, the displacement caused by mining interests, and the destruction of their communities and,
right, so
and areas of life. And that's so that's what's driving them to escape to the UK.
What do you make of that, Mustafa? If the Western powers, the UK, the United States, and other NATO members had not triggered wars, waged wars, waged invasions of other countries or conflicts, interfering in other countries' internal affairs, sovereign countries, that is, such as Libya or Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, then there would be no refugees or asylum seekers in the first place.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you again. And I have to say, I'm talking to you from Libya, where the country is considered one of the favorite transit points or transit countries from Africa to Europe, and as well as from other countries in the region, as far away as Pakistan and Afghanistan. But as you have said, you know, had it not been for the, I mean, we understand migration has always been there. It's part of the human history throughout and for the last thousands of years. That's a natural thing. But what is happening now is that most of the migration we see, probably mostly, especially from the sub-Saharan African countries, has to do with the colonial past of these countries, whereby France, the UK, and Portugal, and the Netherlands, and you name it, used to colonize most of Africa, divided up between themselves, and drove these countries who became independent in the 50s and 60s and up to the 70s, like Rwanda and other countries, who became independent, being unable actually to control their own destiny in terms of the economic development as well as political stabilization inside the country, that would fend off against crises like poverty as well as hunger and insecurity.
Right, indeed.
But when it comes to insecurity specifically, it has to do with the foreign powers, specifically the Western powers, as I mentioned before.
Okay, right. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. John Stepling is an author and commentator. Mustafa Fatouri is a Libyan academic and journalist. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review. So, Israeli violence has claimed the life of another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank, as we reported in this bulletin, the regime's forces opened fire on a Palestinian man near the city of Ramallah. The man was identified as 23-year-old Yazin Omar Jamal Khazib. He succumbed to injuries in hospital. The Israeli military claims Khazib tried to stab the regime's troops. Israeli forces and settlers have ramped up their violence against Palestinians in recent months. The latest death brings to nearly 90 the number of Palestinians killed across the West Bank this year. 17 of those were children. Palestinians across the West Bank and Al-Quds have staged a 24-hour general strike to slam the recent killings and massacres in Jenin. That brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of a speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, after planting saplings on the occasion of Tree Planting Day on March 23. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise God, Almighty God, once again gave me the opportunity this year and previous year to perform my duty to the best of my ability during this season for planting trees. This year, our officials have introduced this slogan, every Iranian should plant three saplings. I, too, planted three saplings today, like other Iranians. If God willing, each Iranian plants three saplings according to the number of people in the nation. What this will mean is that the government's program to plant 1 billion saplings will be achieved within 4 years. So 250 million saplings a year will be planted for 4 years, starting from 1402 solar calendar, God willing. This is an important program. The matter of planting trees, the issue of environmental protection, and the many benefits that arise from an increase in planting saplings and trees in our society and in the country are among the country's most important issues. And this is not limited to us. Some of the neighboring countries have made plans to plant trees up to a certain number, some 4 billion, others 10 billion. Now, how successful they will be in doing this is a whole different topic for discussion. But we can do it.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
God willing, we can plant 1 billion saplings in 4 years. With the people's help, starting from 1402 of solar calendar, God willing. We will be able to plant 1 billion saplings in 4 years' time. God willing, The people will work hard in this field with the help of God. Organizations should also help. Every organization has a duty which they need to perform. One point is that planting saplings is important. It is important for both the environment and the country's economy. A few years ago, a number of people wrote a letter recommending that fruit trees should be planted. So we planted fruit trees. This year, some experts and experienced individuals pointed out that non-bearing trees, forest trees, and various other trees that have wood as their fruit, these are also important for the country.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The German government is planning to implement a new migration policy where asylum seekers will be forcibly sent to other countries in a clear violation of international conventions on the protection of refugees. Already, refugees in Germany are having a hard time and are under pressure to leave.
The worst part is that a lot of people go crazy here in this compound. You hear 8 months, 1 year, they just come and tell you your asylum is over. You have to go back to Italy. Yeah. And you know you are coming from Italy because of the life was not good for you.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In the first segment of our program today, we are focusing on reports that German government is considering deporting asylum seekers and refugees in the country to Eastern Europe and North Africa to then have their asylum claims processed there. We're asking, why is Germany intent on implementing a proposal that is contrary to fundamental human rights? In the second part of our program today, we are looking into reports that the monarchy in Morocco is using an Israeli-produced Pegasus spy program to clamp down on the country's opposition and the Western Sahara independence movement. Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Germany dumping refugees in Africa. The German government is planning to implement a controversial migration policy that will see asylum seekers in the country literally dumped in Africa or Eastern Europe. This decision is expected to be implemented by Joachim Stamp, Germany's first ever special representative of the Federal Government for Migration Agreements.
However, activists working in the field of asylum and migration say Germany has the means to welcome migrants and therefore the decision should not be implemented.
Political leaders have to realize that in creating a feeling of panic, they are helping the extreme right when it tries to denigrate refugees. We want people to show more solidarity with those driven into exile, both in society and in politics. That's how we avoid a repeat of 2015.
And now to discuss Germany's controversial plan to eject refugees and asylum seekers in the country and dump them in Africa, we have contacted Jonathan Ofe and Sir, the publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, why has Germany decided to join the bandwagon of European countries such as Germany and Denmark that plan to dump refugees in other countries, especially in Africa?
Yes, I don't know why Germany, you know, is trying to, well, it's adopting, you know, that policy. Because in principle, if the refugee is from Africa and want to send them back to Africa, it's fine. But to send other nationals from other continents to Africa, you know, like Britain is trying to do, to me, okay, look, Africa, we have our problem. Africa has its problems. So you don't, you know, add the problems by sending refugees from other continents to Africa. Okay, no matter how much, I'm not sure that, you know, the money you pay to the respective African governments or countries, you know, will make up for, you know, the destruction or the problems that will cause for the country concerned. So I see no reason why, you know, Germany is trying to do that. And again, what Germany is trying to do is against, you know, international conventions. Okay, if somebody comes to your country as a refugee and he's refused that refugee status, you send them back to their country of origin, not to a second country.
The British government announced a new migration plan on 14 April 2022. According to the program, some people who came to the UK without a visa or other permission to enter the country will now be sent to Rwanda against their will to have their asylum claim processed and decided there. UNHCR has opposed plans to transfer refugees to other countries, saying such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Filippo Grandi, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, elaborates on why they reject such plans.
This creates a huge precedent, if it happens. It hasn't happened, but if it did happen, it would create a huge precedent. It would mean that a country with resources, as the United Kingdom, with systems and institutions that are able to manage the process of granting asylum, that this country renounces some of these responsibilities and exports them to another country. And by the way, a country with less resources and less capacity to do so. So if this were to happen, what would I then be able to say to leaders, to governments in countries that are not receiving, you know, refugees in their thousands as the UK does, but in their millions, countries in Africa, countries in Asia, in Latin America? What if one of those governments said, we don't want to take them anymore, it's too complicated, let's export them to another country? That would be the end of the practice of asylum as we know it, a practice that is so important to save millions of lives every year.
Despite objection by international organizations, Germany, which claims to respect human rights, is intent on disregarding its international obligations on refugees.
It is just, you know, acting, Germany is just acting with impunity, right? In flouting the international convention on refugees, okay? It thinks it can do whatever it likes. You know, it thinks it can do whatever it likes to do because it needs, you know, to take care of its own nuances, of its own dynamics within the country. So it believes it can go against the UN Convention on Refugees.
UK's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda by force has yet to take off due to ongoing legal challenges. Now, will Germany's plan suffer a similar fate?
Well, it depends on the dynamics in Germany, because what is happening in Britain is that British groups, you know, right groups, refugee groups, you know, and also human rights, other human rights bodies in the UK have, you know, taken legal action against the UK government's move. So whatever happens in Germany will be, you know, as a result of the dynamics in Germany. So you cannot say that because the legal system or the British courts, you know, have temporarily halted, you know, the attempt by the UK government to send refugees to Germany, the same thing might happen to send refugees to Rwanda. It doesn't mean that the same thing might happen, you know, in Germany.
Well, neo-Nazis have rioted in parts of Germany against refugee shelters. There are fears that the number of attacks on refugee homes could go up significantly as more Ukrainian war refugees and asylum seekers from other countries are entering Germany. Now, is the government of Germany reducing the number of refugees in the country under pressure from neo-Nazis and the other far-right xenophobes?
Well, like I said earlier, I believe it is partly so. It's about, you know, it's an irony because earlier this year, the German government said that, look, they needed to fill about 2 million jobs, right? So they were looking outside, you know, to get, you know, immigrants to fill those 2 million jobs. So why, you know, they are trying to send back, you know, refugees, you know, potential refugees to other countries, you know, it beats my comprehension. It beats my understanding. Okay, and again, like I said earlier on, maybe what the German government is doing is pandering to, you know, the agitation by the new Nazi demonstrations or the new Nazi stand against migration to their country. So I believe that maybe the new Nazis are having some effect on German immigration or migration policy.
Iran is hosting millions of refugees amid cruel sanctions imposed by Western countries that are now evading their international obligations regarding protection of refugees. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, has on several occasions praised Iran for hosting millions of Afghan refugees despite receiving minimal support from the international community. During a visit to Iran in 2016, Grandi hailed a decree by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, which ordered schooling be made available for all Afghan children, regardless of their residency status.
Last year's decree of the Supreme Leader allowing all children or Afghan children to have access to schools is one of the most important gestures of solidarity that any country has expressed for refugees anywhere in the world in the past few years. I'm also telling the international community that we should not take for granted the fact that Iran bears the largest cost for hosting hundreds of thousands, in fact millions of Afghans.
Now, what can countries such as Germany and Britain learn from Iran in terms of taking care of refugees?
Germany, Britain, they know it. Okay, look, I believe despite all the sanctions imposed on Iran, Iran has done very well, should be commended for hosting millions of refugees in the country. But look, most Western countries that believe that there's one law for other countries and another law for them. Okay, so they think sometimes they act with impunity. If it does not seal them, they will not do it. It's as simple as that.
Very well put there. The policies of Western countries on refugees are based on double standards, and that's why they are acting with impunity. I would like to thank our guest, Jonathan Ofei Ansah, the publisher of Africa Briefing. Let's now take a short break before our next topic on how Israeli spyware is targeting Morocco's opposition. Stay with us.
Israeli spyware targets Morocco's opposition.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The monarchy in Morocco is using a notorious Israeli Pegasus spyware to clamp down on the country's opposition activists, especially those opposed to the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
This Israeli spyware can be used to access a phone's messages and emails, look through photos, eavesdrop on calls, track the owner's location, and even film them with the camera. The regime in Rabat heightened its crackdown of the opposition using Israeli spyware during the 12th anniversary of the February 20 movement, which in 2011 was the first Moroccan version of the Arab Spring.
Even with the monarchy using this Israeli spyware to monitor the opposition, Moroccans continue to hold rallies around the North African country, calling for greater freedom and to protest against rapid rise in the cost of basic food products. And now to discuss how the Israeli regime is assisting the monarchy in Morocco to clamp down on the country's opposition movement, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe. He's the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. Now, thanks for your time today. Why would the monarchy in Morocco use this Israeli software against its political opponents and journalists?
Well, in Morocco, there is an absolute monarchy. They do not want democratization. They are also occupying the Western Sahara, which was a former Spanish colony. And they have been in defiance of the United Nations since the early 1980s, where they declared that a internationally supervised referendum should take place in the Western Sahara over its future, whether it should be an independent country or whether it should remain connected with Morocco. So Morocco is utilizing the advanced spyware of the Israeli regime to curtail opposition in Morocco and also to help combat the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic in its efforts to form an independent state.
Moroccans have come out to vehemently oppose the decision by the monarchy to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Regular protests take place across Morocco to reject normalization of ties with the Israeli apartheid regime and to express solidarity with Palestinians.
Today we are here as much as with all Moroccans, human rights organizations, political unions that support the Palestinian people, that denounce the war crimes of the Zionist occupation against the Palestinian people. We are also against the normalization of relations of the Moroccan state with Zionism. This march today and all these demonstrations of the Palestinians is supported by several free movements around the world, in Europe, Latin America, the United States and Africa. This normalization must be stopped in our country.
The monarchy continues to suppress citizens opposed to the normalization deal. The Israeli regime was certainly involved in this suppression through this spyware and even weapons.
They want to utilize the Kingdom of Morocco to undermine African support and Middle Eastern support for the Palestinian struggle. It would make sense that they would try to form ties with reactionary and conservative African as well as Arab regimes. We've seen that in regard to Chad, which is a military regime. Also, the Republic of Sudan, they've also attempted this effort as well, even though in Sudan they passed in 1958 when it was a newly independent country. So yes, they are collaborating with these regimes, which have close ties with the United States as well as France. They feel it would be in their interest to suppress, you know, any type of revolutionary or revolutionary democratic governments in the entire region.
One aspect of the normalization of ties between the monarchy in Morocco and the Israeli regime that has drawn criticism is the purchase and use of the Israeli Pegasus spyware. Now, this spyware seems to be one of the baits used by the regime to entice Arab and African countries to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Now, can we say that the Israeli regime is now a real threat to democracy and civil rights in countries that normalize ties with it?
It is. It's a clear threat. We see in Sudan,
that the military regime has resisted any effort to have multi-party elections and to have the military go back to the barracks. We've noticed also within the African Union that Israel is making a new push to obtain observer status within that 55-member continental organization. Just over the weekend, the African Union held its 36th ordinary summit in Ethiopia, and a leading Israeli diplomat came to the conference in defiance of the protocols of the African Union. She was uniformly escorted out of the AU summit just this last past weekend, which drew protest from the Israeli government in Tel Aviv. So this is a multi-pronged strategy on the part of the Israeli government that's backed up by the United States to undermine support for the Palestinian struggle and also to prevent the independence of the Western Sahara.
The leader of the Western Sahara region fighting for independence from Morocco, Brahim Ghali, says the Rabat regime uses the most advanced weapons in the world to attack Sahrawi civilians and neighboring countries. He made the statement mid-January, referring to the military and espionage cooperation between Morocco and the Israeli regime using the Pegasus software.
The Sahara Arab Democratic Republic leadership understands very clearly that the United States and Israel are part and parcel of the national oppressive apparatus in the Western Sahara. They are working in collaboration with each other to prevent the independence of the Western Sahara, as well as to limit and even destroy support international solidarity for the cause of Palestine. We saw in recent months a visit by the president of the SADR to the Republic of South Africa, where he was greeted warmly. We've also noticed that South Africa and Algeria, as well as other countries, have been vehemently opposed to granting observer status to the State of Israel at the African Union. So all of these issues are interrelated, and it's a struggle for democracy, self-determination, and independence, as opposed to colonialism, apartheid, and Zionism.
The Western Sahara leader also says Morocco is dehumanizing the people fighting for freedom and self-determination in this region.
We are facing a phenomenon that mixes between the military occupation and the exercise of racial discrimination. And in addition to systematic human rights violations and plunder and theft of the natural resources, so it's dehumanizing treatment that the Moroccan is doing, exactly like we have been seeing apartheid doing in many African countries.
And now my last question. Can the monarchy in Morocco silence the opposition and the Western Sahara Polisario Front through spying using the Israeli software? Or are we going to see an escalation of demands for democracy in the country?
They may make inroads in regard to suppressing certain aspects of their struggle, but I believe in the long term that the people of Western Sahara will prevail, that the democratic forces in Morocco will also prevail. I think that if you look at what's going on right now in Palestine, despite all the repression and despite the fact that the Israeli regime has moved even further to the right, people are still resisting in the West Bank as well as Gaza and throughout other areas of Palestine. So I think it will be the same situation in regard to the Western Sahara. It was encouraging this weekend to see the actions, the prompt and very decisive actions on the part of the African Union against the Israeli diplomatic attempted intervention in that summit. And this is going to be manifested on a governmental level as well as on a grassroots level throughout Africa as well as West Asia.
Well, there you have it. The Israeli regime's spyware cannot stop the freedom and democratic aspirations of the people of Morocco and other parts of the world. I'd like to thank our guest Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of Pan-African Newswire, for his insight today. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Our special guest speaker for today's discussion from the Islamic House of Qom is Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the whiness of fasting for Muslims. And is it only a special deed and act only for Muslims? And I mean, fasting is only limited to Muslims or not?
Okay, so why do Muslims fast? There are many answers to it, but general answer would be that the Quran, the Lord has told us to fast. And why he has told us to fast are many reasons. One of it is that Ramadan, the word itself, has a root word which means to burn.
Yes,
like
Ramadan.
The sun.
Ramadan.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So because it means to burn in a sense that it burns everything. So here in a specific sense, it means burning your sins. You see, it's the month where you can burn your misdeeds mm-hmm. into good deeds and make sure that you ask for forgiveness, and it's very easily done. You can get it sorted.
That's right.
Yeah.
So burning your sins, burning your fats.
Calories.
Calories, that's right. Okay, it could be also the reason. But all in all, it is not a torture. It is a way through, we can say, perfection. So yeah. Ramadan and the holy months of Ramadan. So that's all right. So fasting is an order by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The quality of fasting is also very important. But is it only for Muslims? I mean, or other religions have fasting too?
In general sense, fasting is there for every religion. In specific sense, this kind of fasting can be found in Islam, like the timing of fasting, why to fast, and the specific details of fasting is in Islam. But remaining fasting as a fast, you can find in many religions, whether it's a religion on polytheism or monotheism. Whether you believe in one God like we have in Christianity, Judaism, and other religions, or, for example, like Hinduism, that is a religion of polytheism, they also have fast in them. The way of fasting, the time of fasting, and the methodology of fasting is different. For example, in Hinduism, we have fasting for where they say that you are not allowed to eat anything, but you're allowed to drink anything that you want, or like water or something you can drink. Yeah. In Christianity, they have fasting period for around 40 days. They might have a bit of difference than the way we fast in Islam. But yeah, fasting in general sense is there in many religions. You can find it. People who approach fasting right now, in general sense, like the way we say wajib, you will find this only in Islam. While in other religions, you will find priests doing this fasting, or those who have reached some elevated state in their position in this church or temple. Those are the people who fast.
That's all right. How do you find the quality of fasting in Islam? I mean, Ramadan, for a whole 1 month, it is not with intervals between, or for example, how can I say, in a consecutive manner, okay? It is just one for whole month. From dusk, from dawn to dusk, you have to be on fasting. You are not allowed to drink. You are not allowed to eat. You are not allowed to do, we can say, the things that are forbidden and might violate, or it's better to say, nullify your fasting. So how do you find the quality of fasting in Islam? I mean, is it only not eating and drinking, or no, or not, for example, doing the forbidden acts? Can we call such a person who is fasting as a Muslim, only with doing this?
So if we come to Islamic laws, anyone who is portraying as a fasting person, a faster, as we would call in some languages, faster, the person is, yes, fasting. If his zahir, his openness, his physical appearance is as fasting, he is fasting. Behind the scenes, if he is doing something else, that is between him and Allah.
Okay.
But in general sense, he is fasting. And normally it's only based in like eating and drinking. Normally these are the only signs that you know,
yes,
that this guy is not fasting in his physical appearance. But apart from that, yeah, for a person who is fasting for Allah, there are a lot of conditions to be portrayed. Like, for example, you don't eat, you don't drink, you don't do certain acts.
Yes.
The sins that are normal in other months, in this month, some of them might even break your fast.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the holy month of Ramadan is the only month where the ibadah does not interfere with your daily work compared to other acts of worship that are wajib, obligatory. For example, if you go for namaz, namaz takes 5 minutes of your day's work, and you break that part and you pray. You see, Hajj, you have to leave certain days, you have to do Hajj, then you come back to your life. But Mahe Ramadan, the fasting, is the only act in Islam that doesn't interfere with your daily life. You see, it's an act that can be done upon another act.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I'm fasting right now, I can speak as well, I'm fasting right now, I can pray as well. In the same state, I can do many things. So it's,
okay,
not a direct interference to my daily work. So this is one of the good things that a lot of people have come up, that fasting is an obligatory action. At the same time, it's something that doesn't require a certain necessity to go out of your daily life.
That's right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
Okay, how to keep the spirit of fasting during, and you know, day by day, you know, maybe the first day might be a little bit difficult for some people. Especially the new fasters, as you said, the new people who come, the new generation, the young generation who want to fast, girls and boys, okay? But day by day, it become easier for the people to do fasting. But I think the spirit of fasting on Ramadan must not be limited only to the holy month of Ramadan, isn't it?
Yeah.
After Ramadan, yeah, it has to be.
The essence itself is the month of Ramadan, but the preparation can start at a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have in traditions that our Aime Masumin used to tell us that they used to teach their kids to pray at the age of 5, and they would advise us to teach our kids to pray at the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
They should fast. They fast at the age of 7, and they told us to train our kids to fast at the age of like 9, for example. You see, obviously, before and after, depending on the gender and everything, has different sidelines. But in general sense, this is how we start. Apart from that, every year when the Maah Ramzan comes, the holy month of Ramadan, before that we have Sha'ban and Rajab, where the emphasis of fasting has been proclaimed in these 2 months. It is much better to understand the value of fasting before reaching it. Because if you want to understand the value of the holy month of Ramadan, is to understand the holy month of Sha'ban.
Yes.
You see, as they say that the holy month of Sha'ban is the Prophet's month.
Yes.
If you understand the Prophet of Allah and if you understand his actions during this month, you will understand much better the influence of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, in the year and the fasting in this month.
Okay. So the preparations before that are really important. That's all right. Some people might ask and say that we fast during the holy month of Ramadan, but at the end of Ramadan, we are not changed. What is the reason? What might be the reason?
That is actually a very big problem if someone comes with that claimation and he says that Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, has not changed him. It's because he has not worked on those protocols that he was supposed to work on. He used to fast, but he was only physically refraining from eating and drinking. But the holy month of Ramadan, the fasting itself, is not only limited to eating and drinking. As I said before, there are some limitations that are kept during the month of fasting, and if you work on that, you will see the difference yourself. Because the holy month of Ramadan, as we see, is the only month where the doors of heaven are open, the doors of hell are closed, and Shaitan is chained.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very practical and best way to approach the holy month of Ramadan. If you're able to work yourself in these chains that the Shaitan before the month of Ramadan has captured you, you're able to restrain yourself, because one of the parts of fasting is restraining. If you restrain yourself properly and well, then after the holy month of Ramadan, you won't fall into the lies of Shaitan again. But if you are not chained, then you have to be like very much specific that where are you going wrong? You might be fasting, but you might still be doing ghibah,
yes,
backbiting. You might be fasting, but you might be looking at the bad things that are around the road, or for example, anywhere. You see, your eyes are very free; they are not controlled. The hijab of the man is not portrayed. The hijab of the woman is not portrayed. You might be fasting, but there are a lot of things that, for example, I know some of the places where backbiting is very norm. It's a norm.
It's a norm, okay.
If you don't backbite, you are out of the society.
Okay.
You see? If you don't, for example, in other cities, if you don't drink, you see?
Yes.
Alcohol, I mean, you are not part of the society. So these are kind of actions that you might be fasting during the daytime, but then when it reaches at the nighttime, you go and follow your desires. While one of the reasons of fasting is to restrain yourself from going to this kind of desires.
This is the question, that after breaking your fast, when iftar is done, you're still fasting.
Yeah.
Okay? The fasting of drinking and eating is finished, but the fasting of the spirit starts, okay?
Yeah.
Or the night. And this is important, I think, how to keep the spirit of fasting during the night too. But unfortunately, in some Muslim lands, you know, Ramadan, because it is the feast of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it is very much limited to the big tables of food, you know, delicious food, colorful food, you know.
It's like you're taking a revenge from God to tell you fasting.
Yeah, that's all right. Okay, unfortunately. Any practical recommendation to keep our fasting strong during the month of Ramadan?
They say that in traditions we have found, as I said before, that whenever you want to enter any, for example, I'm using this clause of an example so that it's easier to understand. Whenever you want to enter an exam room, you prepare before the day of exam.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you read all the required materials and prepare yourself to enter that month, that day of exam. The same goes for the holy month of Ramadan. If you want to enter the month of Ramadan, you need to start drawing out all the black oil and seeds from your heart and your body by doing certain activities that are recommended by the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam.
Yes.
Alayhi salam. So one of those were to fast during the month of Rajab and Sha'ban. The a'mals, the recommended acts that we are supposed to do, for example, like giving sadaqah, praying the namaz of Ja'far al-Tayyar,
yes,
which is one of the best and it has been seen out for anyone who acted according to the way the namaz was prayed and the efficiency